Breaking news for Peoria this morning. Caterpillar has just announced they're moving their headquarters and eventually about 300 jobs to Chicago. We'll have the latest from the Peoria Journal-Star reporter who broke the news. Yesterday, more than 100 medical students protested at Northwestern University in downtown Chicago. They wanted to send a message to Governor Rauner to ask him to make a public statement of support for Medicaid expansion and access to coverage. We'll talk with one of the organizers. Speaking of healthcare, today's the last day to sign up for coverage under the Affordable Care Act. We talked to you about what you need to know. We'll also bring you today the latest in Illinois politics, including an interview with State Treasurer Michael Frerichs about a new program in Illinois to help families with disabilities save money for the future.
You can put money aside for a person with a disability or blindness. You can invest that money. The growth is tax-free as long as it's used for a disability-related expense.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. A surprise announcement from one of Illinois' biggest companies this morning. Caterpillar says it's moving its headquarters by the end of the year from Peoria to Chicago, and eventually about 300 people will be based there. Caterpillar is ranked fifth largest of Illinois companies according to the Fortune 500 list. They've said for years they wouldn't leave Peoria, where the company officially got its start back in 1925. The Peoria Journal-Star's Matt Budell broke the story this morning. He covers Caterpillar for the newspaper, which, as we speak, is printing an extra edition. Matt, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Matt, this is a stark reversal of what Caterpillar has said for years, right, about keeping their headquarters in Peoria. I'm thinking of particular of events. I believe it was last year, former CEO Doug Oberhelman had an event talking about how downtown Peoria was going to be changed by their new headquarters. You had an exclusive interview with the CEO, Jim Umpleby. What did he say about what's changed?
Well, they're pointing to a couple of reasons. The company's declining financial performance is one of the big reasons they're citing for this reversal. The company had its peak revenue of more than $66 billion in 2012. You know, fast forward to the end of 2016, that figure is now $38 billion. And they're saying that this ability to be closer to access to international markets is a driving factor behind moving their upper echelon of executives to the Chicago area.
So how many people exactly are going to be moving to Chicago, Matt, and when's that going to happen?
The plan is for up to 100 employees to move there by the end of this year. And once that new office is fully operational, they're saying 300 employees.
300.
So that includes that includes the CEO, the group presidents, a couple few vice presidents, and some support staff, including people from the legal department, human resources, and the financial area of Caterpillar.
And Matt, can you give us a sense of what will be staying in Peoria and how many people will still be employed in the Peoria area by Caterpillar?
Well, what the CEO talked about yesterday was that there are still more than 12,000 Caterpillar employees in the Peoria area, and a vast majority of them will remain here. They're framing this as a very small percentage of employees overall leaving the Peoria area.
What has Caterpillar said in the past about its commitment to downtown Peoria, to headquarters? This is something that's a little surprising, this sudden announcement this morning.
As you said earlier, it is a stark reversal. If you go back to 2012, the company initiated a study of modernization of its headquarters, and throughout that process, in public statements from the company, they reiterated commitment to Peoria, to the Peoria region, and then in February of 2015, to pretty great fanfare with the governor here, lots of dignitaries, they unveiled plans for a new global headquarters on a site pretty much adjacent to where the headquarters downtown is now. Then CEO Doug Oberhelman said, "We're staying in Peoria. I repeat, we're going to stay in Peoria." And there was a very good reception of that message at the time.
Well, and he also said, I'm thinking about how much he said he was committed to maintaining Peoria culture. CEO Jim Umpleby, he's what, a month into his tenure? How long has he been CEO, Matt?
The announcement that Oberhelman was retiring as CEO at the beginning of this year came last October. So at the same time, they announced Umpleby would be taking over at the beginning of this year. So mm-hmm. He's been CEO officially for a month. He's been a group president and in Peoria for since 2013. However, you know, he's been with the company since it acquired Solar Turbines in San Diego in 1990.
And what did Jim Umpleby say to you when you talked to him about how much the company, how much Caterpillar was committed to Peoria?
Well, I mean, he essentially said that the management team's focus now is to grow the company again, and they felt it was essential for to facilitate that growth, to have the management team and the upper executives in this new location.
In Chicago, because of its access to airports and things like that.
As a global transportation hub, that's correct. And, you know, he did cite specifically that this was a Caterpillar board of directors decision, and one that he and the executive staff supported. Former CEO Doug Oberhelman, you know, remains the chairman of the Caterpillar board through the end of March. So he additionally was part of this decision-making process.
As we're you mentioned this at the beginning, Matt, 2012. Actually, that's back when I used to cover Caterpillar. You were saying, that sort of seems like, based on its performance over the past couple of years, the peak financial year for the company. What are Caterpillar's finances looking like right now? What's the business looking like for the company this year?
Well, when we're speaking about a company as complex as Caterpillar, it becomes kind of difficult to speak in generalities. So let me use a specific example to illustrate their struggles. You know, one of Caterpillar's kind of most visible products and high margin products, frankly, are the large mining trucks. In 2012, they produced 1,200 of those. Last year, they made 80. So it's a significant, significant decline. The 2016 year-end financials that were just released last week showed, like I said earlier, $38 billion in sales and revenue for the year. They're projecting for 2017 to be about the same. Right now, they're saying $37.5 billion for the year. But you got to look at, you know, if you look back to what they projected for 2016 and in 2015, you know, they missed that mark significantly from the very beginning. So there's a lot yet to be seen. There's been a lot of hope in regards to infrastructure projects and, other news coming out of the Trump administration, how it might benefit a business such as Caterpillar, who has long championed tax reform and some of the issues that Donald Trump has talked about. However, those things take time, and Caterpillar doesn't anticipate seeing any benefit from those things if they come to fruition until, you know, into 2018.
I know that Congressman Darren LaHood, he's a Republican. He represents the 18th District of Illinois. He just put out a statement. He says, I'm stunned, saddened, and extremely frustrated to hear the news that Caterpillar's corporate world headquarters will abruptly be moving from Peoria to Chicago. This is sad news for our community. To say I'm disappointed would be a tremendous understatement. This is in some ways a betrayal of our community and in complete disregard for the hardworking employees and citizens of Peoria. That's Congressman Darren LaHood. Matt, what are business and local business and community leaders, are they in agreement with Congressman LaHood? Like, what's the feeling this morning in Peoria?
I think it's mixed, and I think that you'll have to see those reactions evolve over time. This has been despite some, you know, kind of ongoing circulating rumors, this was a fairly well-kept secret. Caterpillar didn't begin informing city leaders about this until this morning. So now, with that said, I suspect that the gut reaction of a lot of people will be very similar to the statement that Darren LaHood released.
Caterpillar was founded in Peoria officially in April of 1925. Can you give us a sense of the history of Peoria and how closely it's tied to Caterpillar?
I don't think you can separate Caterpillar from Peoria or Peoria from Caterpillar. You know, those long roots have not just created the world's largest manufacturer of earth-moving equipment. They've also fostered an entire network of support businesses all throughout the Peoria area. And this has got to be giving those business owners and those people who regularly do business with Caterpillar pause and a lot of uncertainty.
That's the Peoria Journal-Star's Matt Budell. He broke the story this morning that Caterpillar is moving its headquarters, just its headquarters, we should point out to everyone, from Peoria to Chicago. Going to be happening very quickly. That's going to be happening by the end of the year. You can follow Matt. We tweeted out his story. If you follow 2NST Show, the Peoria Journal-Star is printing an extra edition this morning for their coverage of this huge story for Peoria and the region. Matt, thanks for taking the time to join us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for reaching out. I appreciate it.
Yesterday in Chicago, more than 100 medical students and faculty members gathered at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine to lay down their white coats in protest of a pending repeal of the Affordable Care Act. The White Coats for Coverage event was part of a nationwide Do No Harm Day of Action. 20 other medical schools across the country organized in protest. I'm joined now by one of the organizers of the Chicago event. Michelle Gorecki is a medical student at Northwestern University. Michelle, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What message were you and your fellow students and faculty members, medical professionals, trying to send through this demonstration about the Affordable Care Act, Michelle?
We're calling on Governor Rauner and our elected officials to protect our patients by maintaining their access to health care, regardless of what happens on the national level. We're asking elected officials to not pull the rug out from our patients by taking the following actions. First, make a public statement of support for Medicaid expansion and low-income insurance subsidies. Second, introduce state legislation to maintain coverage levels above pre-ACA norms. And third, prevent patients from being dropped from their health plans due to pre-existing conditions. Yesterday, Northwestern medical students and faculty laid down their white coats to form a white coat carpet.
What did that look like, that white coat carpet? What did you guys actually do?
So first, we had a few speakers. We heard from a few physicians about the importance of the ACA. We heard from Ed Hines, who was representing Senator Dick Durbin, about how, on a national scale, his efforts to protect the ACA. And then finally, we heard from a third-year medical student about her experiences working with patients who had really complicated healthcare needs, but they were able to access excellent care through the ACA.
And so did you guys Michelle, did you guys actually take off your coats, or what did you guys do? Or was it mostly just an event where the people were speaking? Oh, okay.
No. So after we heard about the importance of it and why we're here, then we lined up and formed like an open aisle. And people then began taking off their white coats and formed like a 2-white coat wide carpet. And then we had a moment of silence where we stood in solidarity with our patients, and then, you know, took some pictures for the press after that.
Why was it important for you to do this?
You know, I think as medical professionals, we do have a voice, and we have the opportunity to advocate for some of our neediest patients. Our healthcare is really excellent for people who can access it, but many groups are disproportionately excluded from the health system due to their income, race, or geographic location. I chose a career in medicine to serve the people who need it the most, and the ACA has allowed many of the neediest patients to access care.
Did you see, I wonder, I mean, you're sending around a petition to be sent to Governor Rauner and Illinois lawmakers. I'm sure you saw the letter his insurance chief sent to Washington recently, a pretty unusual position he took, being vocal about the need not to repeal the ACA without a replacement. Do you feel that didn't go far enough?
We agree that repealing the ACA without a replacement is a bad strategy, but we feel that Governor Rauner could take a further step by speaking out for support of Medicaid expansion. For example, Governor Kasich recently spoke out saying that if patients don't get coverage, they end up in the emergency room, they end up sicker and more expensive, so we're going to be paying for patients one way or the other, and we believe Governor Rauner should do what he can to protect our patients.
And so for you, as someone who's a medical student and a future doctor, do you feel like this is something you'd like to see more doctors speaking out about?
I do. I feel we, when we come together, we do have a voice. And it's important for medical students to speak out, too, because with the U.S. facing a shortage of healthcare workers in just about every field, after we graduate, we can choose to live and practice in just about any state. And so if Illinois has a more functional healthcare system, it will be conducive to recruiting and retaining healthcare providers here.
That's Michelle Gorecki. She's a medical student at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, one of the organizers. She was describing to us that white coat protest that took place in downtown Chicago yesterday. Michelle, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, today is actually the last day to sign up for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. You have until midnight to do that. We are going to be speaking with senior writer for TriMed Media Group, healthcare reporter John Gregory, coming up on the 21st. If you got questions about it, give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21ST Show, and we will continue this conversation about the Affordable Care Act. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today's the last day to sign up for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. As we were just talking about, students yesterday, Northwestern University medical students protesting in downtown Chicago over the Affordable Care Act. Lots of folks with all the discussion about it may forget that today is actually the last day. If you want to sign up, you have until midnight to do that. To learn about what enrollment is looking like so far and what you need to do if you still want to sign up, we're joined by John Gregory, who's a senior writer for TriMed Media Group in Chicago. Hey, John, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, John, I think with all the discussion about ACA and Obamacare, people might not actually be thinking about, people are talking about whether it will be repealed or replaced. The conversation of people actually signing up might be lost in that. What are numbers looking like for how much people have signed up for this year compared to last year?
Well, they're a little out of date because they haven't been updated since the transition at the presidential level took over. The last enrollment snapshot was released on January 14th and showed 8.8 million people signed up compared to 8.7 million last year just through the federal healthcare.gov site, which does cover Illinois. In Illinois, it's just under 354,000. That's about 91% of last year's total of 388,000. Now, if you factor in the state marketplaces, which have been updating their numbers more regularly, there's about 12.7 million, I'm sorry, about 11.8 million confirmed enrollees right now, compared to 12.7 million who had signed up in the open enrollment of all of last year.
So, John, I know we saw news last week the Trump administration pulled the plug on ads and outreach surrounding the Affordable Care Act. They said it was a cost-saving measure. Is this something that, I don't know how much ads and things like that make a difference. Do we find that a lot of people sign up at the last minute on the last day?
Yes, they do. About 800,000 people signed up just on healthcare.gov in the last 5 days of open enrollment last year. And the numbers I told you before, 11.8 million confirmed nationwide right now and 12.7 million signed up in 2016. Do the math. That about makes up the difference in those last 5 days. Now, the ads were originally, they were pulling everything, and then they did pull back on that by allowing the outreach, the phone calls and emails to people who hadn't completed their application but had started one. Those are still going out. Since those efforts had already been paid for, They really couldn't justify the cost saving aspect of this if they pulled things that had already not been paid for. So that could have been a move by the Trump administration to make sure some people just forgot to sign up in the last day's enrollment, and then they could come out later with lower figures as proof of the law's problems, and it backs up their side of the argument on the ACA.
Thanks for that clarification, John. That's helpful. So obviously, is there a sense that people are worried about losing coverage in the sense if lawmakers succeed at dismantling Obamacare? How would that work for this year logistically?
Well, logistically for this year, it'd be very hard for anyone to lose coverage mid-year. The exception to that would be if through the reconciliation process in Congress, which allows them to avoid a filibuster in the Senate, they reduce what are called cost-sharing reductions for insurers. If they did that, that actually triggers an exit clause for the insurers that they can terminate their plans immediately and pull out of the market. And therefore, yes, the people who were covered under those plans, they wouldn't be paying anymore, but they wouldn't be covered anymore either. Now, that would be that's something that Republicans are aware of. And the real danger is not for this year, it's next year. And most insurers are saying if it's this uncertain, why would we sign up to provide insurance coverage in the next year? But for this year, plans should be safe, except for this very narrow circumstance.
Ben just tweeted at us that the ACA isn't perfect, but far better than nothing, and can and should be improved, not destroyed. He's saying the GOP has presented no replacement plan. That's Ben tweeting to us at 21ST Show. You can always join the conversation and tweet to us as well. What is the latest news we're looking at, John, with what Washington lawmakers are proposing regarding a repeal, regarding replacement? There's lots of news going on last week. People might have missed what happened with ACA.
Well, they've seemed to have backed off any strategy of repeal and delay. There are some people pushing for as long as 4 years of delay of pushing back the effects, the possibly harmful effects of repealing it. That seems to have been taken off the table because of what I said about insurer uncertainty. If they don't know what the market's going to look like next year, they're just not going to come in, and that removes any advantages of a delay. But there are several plans floating out around there. Trump's nominee for the Department of Health and Human Services, Tom Price, he had a plan. Rand Paul came out with a plan, but the most buzz I'm hearing about is a plan called the Patient Freedom Act. It's from Susan Collins of Maine and Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, both U.S. senators. It can best be described as kind of an elevator pitch for it, as if you like your Obamacare, you can keep it. It'll allow states to keep the ACA system in place with almost all the current funding if their own elected state officials choose to do so. And considering Governor Rauner has urged caution to Trump on a too quick ACA repeal, he could be open to that. But there's still no push and kind of consensus behind one single plan. They're still struggling with that, and they're starting to realize the reality of the implications of pulling away at this too quickly.
That's John Gregory. He's a senior writer for TriMed Media Group covering healthcare in Chicago. John, thanks for updating us on the Affordable Care Act.
Thank you.
Every week, we like to spend some time keeping you updated on what's happening in Illinois politics with a couple political reporters from around the state. We're joined on the line now from Springfield WICS political reporter Jordan Abadea and the Chicago Tribune's Monique Garcia. Jordan, Monique, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Jordan, let's start with you. Yesterday, we were talking about President Trump's immigration ban last weekend, how it affected Illinois residents. We've been hearing state political leaders, how they've been responding to President Trump's immigration ban this past weekend. It looks like Senator Durbin is actually talking about it right now on the Senate floor, and he's questioning Jeff Sessions about this right now. But I want to focus back to Illinois leaders and ask you, what has Governor Rauner said about this executive order?
Governor Rauner has had to tread lightly around this topic because he is a Republican, but he doesn't want to tie himself to President Trump. He has worked very hard to not endorse him and not say much about his presidency. The governor has come out and said that he, you know, thinks that we need to live up to American values and that this needs to be fully vetted, but he works very hard to not outright come out against President Trump or support him. So the governor is walking a tightrope right now.
And Monique, this weekend, Governor Rauner was in California meeting with the Koch brothers, major money influencers in the GOP party. They actually put out some interesting statements condemning the foundation, saying that the Koch brothers are not happy with this immigration ban. But Monique, can you remind us, why was Governor Rauner meeting with them? What was he doing in Palm Springs?
Well, he was out there to help raise money, and he has done that for a while now. His office says he was out there to promote some of the criminal justice reforms that he's pushing in the state, but it's a way for the governor to be around some big money donors and for the governor to give some of his own big money, which he's not been afraid to do in the past, and we continue to see him do on both the national and the state level.
And so he was out there this weekend. Late last week, we saw a state attorney general making a move that surprised a lot of people. And I wanted to ask you about that because Governor Rauner in the past couple of days has been commenting on that. She is seeking, let's just remind everybody, she's seeking to stop Illinois from paying state employees until a state budget is passed. Monique, how can she go about making this happen? What's the background here?
Well, this dates back to a ruling in July of 2015, shortly after the state entered into this long exodus of not having a budget. So back then, the Attorney General went to court arguing that the state did not have the authority to pay employees beyond the federal minimum wage because there was no state appropriation, there was no budget. At the time, the governor and former Republican comptroller Leslie Munger, who was appointed by Rauner, fought that. They went to a different court and were successful in issuing a stay and ensuring that state employees continued to get paid. That has pretty much been the operating law for the last 18 months or so as we've gone from stopgap budget to stopgap budget, all just kind of taking advantage of this rule that was in place by the courts to ensure that state employees got paid. Well, last week, the Attorney General said enough is enough. You guys are taking advantage of this, and the budget impasse has gone on too long. She said that in no uncertain terms, she was very clear that she's trying to put pressure on the governor and on Democratic lawmakers to try to reach a budget agreement, and says that, you know, at the national level, whenever these kind of impasses go on, there's usually some sort of breaking point. There's some kind of commotion, and perhaps that this will be the issue that forces you to the table.
That's the Chicago Tribune's Monique Garcia. We're also speaking with WCIS's News Channel 20's Jordan Abadea. And Jordan, Monique mentioned former comptroller Leslie Munger. Now is her Democratic comptroller Susana Mendoza. Governor Rauner brought her into the picture. What is he asking her to do?
So Governor Rauner's top legal counsel sent the new comptroller basically a letter saying that Comptroller Munger, when she was in office, hired an outside attorney. They fought this. We need you to basically do the same thing. That remains to be seen on if Comptroller Mendoza is going to do the same thing that Comptroller Munger did at the time. We reached out to her office for a comment, and they basically said that if the governor had done his job and proposed a balanced budget and worked with the General Assembly to get a budget, we wouldn't be in this situation. And so we've seen that, you know, every time that this budget impasse has dragged on further and further and further, it's because some other pressure was lifted. You know, once the courts decided state workers could be paid, that pressure was no longer there. Once lawmakers decided that they were going to fund K-12 education, that pressure was no longer there. And so I think some people are saying if the pressure is there, that they'll finally be forced to sit down and get a budget. So we don't know how Comptroller Mendoza is going to handle this.
Yeah. Monique, what's your sense? Could this be finally the pressure point that everyone's been talking about?
I think that's yet to be seen. seen in their arguments against this bringing about resolution. Republicans in the governor's office have argued that this is some kind of Democratic conspiracy to derail these talks that we've seen in the Senate, these bipartisan talks that have kind of had fits and starts over the last month or so to try to bring about a budget resolution. They say that, you know, they note that the Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, her father is House Speaker Michael Madigan, who is one of, you know, the governor's biggest foils in the legislature. And they say this is, you know, Madigan, the Madigans together working to try to derail a larger deal and just try to push through another smaller stopgap budget. And so we're really going to have to wait to see once lawmakers come back next week if this is helping focus attention or if this is another distraction.
Yeah, you know, and as you say that, Monique, I spoke to State Treasurer Michael Frericks about all of this. We're going to hear more from him in a couple minutes about a new state savings program he unveiled yesterday, a multi-state initiative to help families with disabilities. But here's what he had to say after I asked him if state lawmakers are concerned about credit agencies, because they've been warning about Illinois' credit rating again being downgraded if it continues to operate without a budget.
Most certainly. This is clear to every citizen of the state. They're frustrated. But here is an example of a real-life consequence. So when the governor's office goes out and issues more debt, and they've done this numerous times, when they issue debt, when we have a lower credit rating, we all pay more in interest. When the governor goes out and issues debt, it's like ripping extra dollars out of the wallets of people in our state. The first priority should be right now getting a balanced budget passed. The rating agencies have said this is a big part of the reason why we've had these credit downgrades. It should be the number one priority above and beyond any other personal agenda.
That's State Treasurer Mike Frericks. He's talking about interest on debt being issued. Monique, I want to ask you about another set of interest that's piling up here, because you were reporting in the Tribune yesterday, Illinois is looking at $15 billion in unpaid bills. We're not even thinking about the interest that's building up on those unpaid bills. Do we know how much the state and ultimately taxpayers are going to have to be paying on interest for that backlog?
Well, we have a new estimate from Comptroller Mendoza's office. This last week, she had said that it looks like, because of this huge backlog of unpaid bills, that for this fiscal year alone, which we're only 6 months through, by the way, that right now it looks like we're going to pay about $700 million in interest on back bills. And this is because the state has a law that was put in place during as part of its continuing efforts to try to get its financial house in order, that if the state does not pay vendors on time, the interest clock starts going. So it's about 9% a year for medical bills and medical vendors, and it's 1% a month after a certain time period for those who provide, let's say, paper for different various agencies. So that keeps piling up. We're expected to hit $15 billion by the end of the year, and if we're not paying our bills, we're not paying our interest, so it keeps growing and it keeps growing. But even that $700 million figure from the comptroller's office is up for debate. They say, frankly, that that's a conservative number, and that if nothing changes, it's going to go even higher. The governor's office, budget office, has declined to provide an estimate. They say they can't, you know, speculate into the future. Though I'll note that they have not been afraid to give projections on various other budget plans when they choose to do so. So this is an extra debt that every taxpayer is eventually going to be on the hook for.
So let's just repeat that number for everyone, Monique, because I think it's kind of hard to comprehend. $15 billion in unpaid bills and an interest, and right now a conservative estimate of the interest we're paying is $700 million?
Yes, $700 million for 1 year. That's likely to go up when you kind of add in some of the costs for the last budget year that we were in, that we didn't pay our bills, the one we're still going through if we ever see a resolution. And I'd note that that $700 million figure is for 1 year, when in the previous 10 years before the budget impasse, we paid out a total of $1
billion. Wow.
So we're almost at that $1 billion mark in just 2 years.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to find out if lawmakers have a plan for how to pay back that interest on that debt. We're talking to Monique Garcia and Jordan Abadea. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guests are political reporters Jordan Abadea, WCIS News Channel 20, Monique Garcia from The Tribune, State House Bureau reporter. We're talking right now about Illinois' $15 billion backlog in unpaid bills. Monique's been telling us about the $700 million in interest. Monique, with all the discussions about the lack of a budget, I do want to get into sort of the logistics of the quote unquote grand bargain compromise that senators have been trying to put together. Has lawmakers talked about a plan for how to pay back the interest on this debt?
Yes, they have. So this massive, massive plan that's under talks includes various tax increases. This thing continues to evolve. So it changes, but it's continuing to change, but it does call for at least an income tax increase, maybe an expansion of taxes on various services like haircuts and storage, and also a large gaming expansion. And some of that money that would be generated by those taxes would be used to pay off a line of borrowing to pay down this backlog of bills. The current figure being discussed is borrowing about $7 billion, which would be repaid over a period of 7 years. The comptroller's office says, you know, they're studying that, but they have questions on whether or not borrowing $7 billion is enough, or should we try to borrow more given the pile of bills that keeps growing. So the idea here is that it's like a refinancing, where it might be cheaper to borrow this large amount of money from Wall Street than to borrow it at a higher interest rate from thousands of different state vendors. The concern, of course, being, as mentioned earlier, is the state's credit rating. We already have the lowest credit rating in the nation, and several ratings agencies have warned that a downgrade could come any day now, so it could be more expensive for the state to borrow to pay these down.
Jordan, let's talk a minute about what attempts, if any, are being made to resolve the budget impasse. We had so much conversation a week or in the past couple of weeks about this grand bargain, these 13 proposed bills to try to push through a new state budget. Lawmakers adjourned. We didn't see much action on that. Where are we at with that?
So now, lawmakers are on a quick break, and they're going to keep negotiating. We had expected a vote last week when they were in town, but they essentially, I think, heard from both of their caucuses, and there were a lot of concerns because, as Monique mentioned, anytime a bill or a bargain is this large, encompassing this many facets, you're going to have people on both sides who have concerns with multiple parts. And so I think they're still trying to figure out the best formula of what's going to look best and what they can put their members on a vote for. You know, but when it all comes down to it, the question has been for almost 2 years now, is this worth it? Is this impasse and the backlog of bills piling up and the debt and the credit downgrades, is this all worth it? And I know Monique has asked the governor this. I've asked the governor this. Most of the State House Bureau reporters have asked this. And he'll say yes, because we cannot keep going on the track we were going. He says that if we don't change, then things are going to continue to get worse and government spending is going to continue to outpace our growth. And so that's the fundamental question. I think a lot of Democrats will tell you this isn't worth it. The state's credit being downgraded isn't a good thing for business, and thousands of social service agencies closing their doors is also not good for people in the state. And so this has ultimately been the question for 2 years, and unless people come to the table and sit down and figure out a deal, I don't see how this moves forward.
And I wanted to ask, Monique, I wonder if you could weigh in here on AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Workers. That's the largest state worker union. We've sort of seen Governor Rauner originally talking about his quote-unquote turnaround agenda. He was having lots of discussions about unions and how much he wanted to limit their rights. Now they're asking members to challenge Governor. They're in the middle of contract negotiations. And I wonder what's going on. They're asking members if they're eligible to strike. Is there a current plan for AFSCME to strike? How likely is that to happen, Monique?
Well, right now, as you mentioned, there is a vote going on. It should go on over the next couple weeks at about 700 different work sites, asking members if they want to strike. The union has been very clear, though, that they want to avoid getting to that point. They're hoping that by having a strike authorization vote, by indicating to the governor's office that they are willing to go after a work stoppage, that that will perhaps bring him back to the negotiating table. Both sides recognize how devastating it would be if state government simply stopped working. Both sides say they want to avoid that, but right now it really is a big game of chicken, and we'll have to wait probably until later in February to decide, you know, who's going to blink.
Yeah. If both of you want to jump in here, I want to ask both of you this one last question. We've just got a couple minutes left, and it has to do with Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, Governor Rauner, President Trump. You know, last week we saw Mayor Emanuel getting into a little war of words with President Trump in response to his comments on Chicago violence. I know this past weekend Mayor Emanuel showed up at O'Hare. He called on yesterday Chicago residents. He's saying they should be hosting refugees and immigrants in their homes. Everyone should be reaching out and welcoming people, and they want everyone to know that Chicago is a welcoming city in direct response to the president's immigration ban. We also saw Governor Rauner in the State of the State address sort of talking a lot about Chicago violence. And I want to ask both of you what you think, if you see sort of rising tension between Rahm Emanuel, President Trump, and Governor Rauner. Certainly Mayor Emanuel and Governor Rauner haven't been on the best of terms the past year or two. I wonder what you think that means for Illinois. Monique, you want to start?
Well, I think it's yet to be determined. I think it's very clear that there's going to be this fight, and there's going to continue to be a fight, and it's probably going to get worse between the mayor and the president. Chicago is a Democratic city. It's not going to change anytime soon, and so it's very clearly in the crosshairs of President Trump, as you saw with the immigration issue, also with the violence issue. But I would note that when the President Trump sent that tweet out last week saying, you know, I'll send in the feds, it was something that even Governor Rauner, a Republican, opposed. You know, nobody thinks that it's a really good idea to have militarized police on the streets of Chicago. They say the real answer is more investment in education, more investment in these after-school programs, anti-violence programs. Meanwhile, the feds are looking to possibly cut some of that funding as part of this immigration debate over sanctuary cities, while Democrats will note in the State House that Governor Rauner has proceeded over a lack of a budget for 2 years. That's also cut those same programs that they argue help spur some of this violence in Chicago.
Yeah, Jordan, we've just got about 30 seconds left, but certainly that is, Governor Rauner did talk about these programs in his State of the State address last week, didn't he, about investing in Chicago more?
Yeah, and the governor has said that the state is not being compassionate right now because we're not competitive. So for Governor Rauner, those two things are linked, and in order for the state to be competitive, we need his reforms, according to him. And once we get those reforms, then the economy grows and more money can be invested in those programs. In the meantime, though, there's not really a plan for what happens to those programs while there is no budget for 2 years and maybe not a budget for another year, what the plan is going forward. So we'll have to wait and see how that all plays out.
Ms. Jordan Abadea, she's the political reporter for WCIS News Channel 20. I want to thank also Monique Garcia, State House Bureau reporter with the Chicago Tribune. Jordan, Monique, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yesterday, State Treasurer Michael Frerichs announced a new multi-state partnership aimed at helping especially families with disabilities save money for the future. At the federal level, the program is known as the Achieving a Better Life, or the ABLE Act. The National Disability Institute estimates there are 58 million people with disabilities in the United States. Many will be eligible for this program. It was adopted by the state of Illinois last year. Yesterday was its official start. Illinois led the way on this multi-state effort, and we spoke with Treasurer Frerichs earlier to learn more about the program. Treasurer, welcome back to the 21st.
Nyla, good morning.
Good morning. This sounds a lot like accounts that people might be familiar with, like education savings plans for college. Is that what this is like?
It is very similar to a 529 college savings plan. In the state of Illinois, the treasurer's office manages Bright Starts and Bright Directions. You put money aside, you invest it. The growth in those accounts are tax-free as long as they're used for higher education-related expenses. The ABLE accounts, or Achieving a Better Life Experience accounts, are similar. You can put money aside for a person with a disability or blindness. You can invest that money. The growth is tax-free as long as it's used for a disability-related expense. And then it has the added benefit of up to $100,000 can be put into that account without it affecting their Social Security benefits. So a lot of families with a child with disabilities are very excited about this program.
How is this different, Treasurer, from, say, a flexible spending account? I imagine a lot of people would think for healthcare expenses for families or people coping with disabilities, they would use something like that instead of this program.
Well, this is for those families who want to put something aside for their child to give them a brighter future. Right now, in order to receive Social Security benefits, that individual can't have more than $2,000 in assets. They basically have to spend down everything they have. This will allow those families to put aside up to $100,000 and still receive their benefits. We were really excited the federal government gave us the opportunity to create this program in 2015. We passed it in 2015. We ran into some oppositions. We ran into some concerns out there, but we worked through them and very proud to announce that we're going live now.
And so prior to the enactment of this law in Illinois, what you're saying about people saving, people actually could be penalized, right, for saving. You could be penalized in the sense of losing certain federal benefits from Medicaid or, as you said, from Social Security if their savings exceeded certain limits?
Yeah, if you wanted to leave something for your loved one, for your child with a disability or blindness, and you didn't have enough money to set up a special needs trust, if they could not work for themselves and were relying on Social Security benefits, they'd have to spend down all of their assets before they could begin receiving those benefits. This will allow families to create a little more of a nest egg for the person they love in their life. That's why we're so excited about this. But when we first went out and started talking to investment managers, they weren't so interested in administering this program. It left us scratching our head, and so we had to have conversations with them, and they said, well, we just don't have the economies of scale. There just aren't enough families in your state for us to make it work. So we put on a thinking cap. We called other states, tried to talk, see what problems they were having. They had the same issues, and we had this great idea, well, what if we worked together? And so Illinois led a joint effort, which is now the National ABLE Alliance, comprised of 14 different states with about a quarter of the country's population. And now we have given those investment firms a much larger pool of people with greater economies of scale, and we will have the program with the lowest fees in the country, with robust investment options, with zero fee banking options. And it took us a while, but we've done it right.
And that program, as you're saying, this is for people to set aside sort of a nest egg. There are limits on what that money can be spent on, correct?
There are limits, but they're not too extensive. It has to be spent on a disability-related expense. But if you need to buy a vehicle to allow you to transport the individual around, that would be counted. For therapies, for physical treatment, for a wheelchair, for a renovation of the house in order to make it handicap accessible. There are a large variety of allowable expenses. But it definitely cannot be used on alcohol or gambling. That's very clear.
Treasurer, who's eligible for these ABLE accounts?
People who meet the standards for a disability, if they're able to receive Social Security Disability Insurance or SSI, they most likely qualify for setting up an ABLE account.
And why is this run under the Treasurer's Office?
Well, we pushed this initiative around the country. It's set up in different offices. But we worked with State Senator Scott Bennett. He passed this legislation out of the Senate. We work very closely with him. I think it makes sense in the Treasurer's Office because we also manage the state's 529 college savings plans. And this is in the same section of the IRS code that has made sense. This is an investment option. And as the Treasurer, I'm the Chief Investment Officer of the state of Illinois. We invest the state's resources. But what we also try to do is give people the tools they need to invest in themselves, helping them to save their kids' college education, helping them to save for their retirement, and now helping to give their children with a disability or blindness a brighter future.
State Treasurer Mike Frerichs talking to us about what he's been working on, the ABLE Act. Again, Treasurer Frerichs, thanks for being with us.
Nyla, thank you very much.
We'll tweet out all the information about that. If you follow us at 21ST Show, it'll all be at our website, www.21stshow.org. Again, just to follow up on our breaking news story from this morning, a big announcement from Caterpillar announcing that they're moving their headquarters by the end of the year from Peoria to Chicago. Earlier in the hour, we did hear Congressman Darren LaHood saying he was frustrated and disappointed in the Caterpillar move. State Senator Dave Kaler has also, a Democrat, has issued the following statement saying he's very saddened by the news. He says this is very unfortunate for Peoria. It's something, quote, everyone feared but had hoped would never happen. In a year in which the news from Caterpillar has been devastating to many families, this becomes another blow to our economy. I'm hoping that Peoria will rebound from this decision. So stay tuned for that. We'll have that continuing coverage on that later this week and this afternoon. 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.